My brethren and sisters, it's really a wonderful morning. Mornings don't get much better than high in the summer. Afternoon's another story. This chapter starts by indicating that there was a period of time that goes by. I think yesterday we read that it was like in the third year of the king, and we're going to find that as we read down through here, Esther becomes queen, I think, in the seventh year. And there's a year in between. So it's been some time since the king has decided to get a new queen. So there's some speculation. You know, I think Brother Jim may have mentioned yesterday that there was, you know, this king had that number of battles and fought in a lot of different, you know, things, and he was probably pretty busy doing king stuff. Certainly, he was not without female companionship as far as the second harem goes. So, it starts out by using the words, the phrase, after these things. Now, the Jewish Bible translation says, a while later. I'm not sure it makes that much of a difference, but we get the idea that the king's anger against Vashti, you know, had subsided, and he was thinking about the decree he had made. Perhaps he wasn't sure he did the right thing, whatever, but it leads to the suggestion that he go out and get a beautiful young virgin to become queen. So, all those, you know, throughout the empire were then being selected, and this is what chapter 2 tells us about how this all transpires. First thing we get here, before we find out, we get introduced to Esther, we get introduced to Mordecai. Now, he's a Benjamite. I don't know the full significance of that, if anything. But, he was taken captive at the time of Jeconiah, king of Judah, by Nebuchadnezzar. Brother H.P. Mansfield writes that his feelings were that Mordecai would have heard the prophecies of Daniel and witnessed some of the marvelous things that had taken place in Babylon. He had seen Cyrus come to power and had gradually risen to a position of authority in the service of the kings of Persia. Darius Hystaspes, had shown a kindness to the Jews when he decreed that every assistance should be given to them in rebuilding the temple, shortly after he had come to power. Perhaps Mordecai had some influence in such a decision. We don't really know. That's Brother Mansfield's comment. But Mordecai had a young cousin whose parents, you know, had died, and Mordecai raised her as his own daughter, as we're told. In Hebrew, her name was Hadassah. And I remember growing up in Brooklyn, and I used to deliver newspapers. And there's a lot of Jewish people there. And there was some kind of, I'd go over some of it by their doorposts, and there was Hadassah. You know, I think it was, I won't call it a club, but it was some Jewish association. It's kind of interesting. But her name means Michael. But we know her better as Esther. Esther, that name comes from the Persian Stara, S-T-A-R-A. Thus star, or from Ishtar, a Babylonian goddess. And her name is also identified with the root Sathar, S-A-T-H-A-R, to hide. And we know that her identity was hidden. So it's kind of appropriate. Where she got her name, we're not really told, per se. Perhaps Mordecai told her, your name is Esther. We don't really know for sure. And so we are introduced to Esther, the Hadassah. Now, visualize this in your mind. We're told that she was very beautiful, but not only in physical appearance. And here's the key, and this is probably what ultimately, she's found in favor. So she grew up a very beautiful woman, attractive in every way. Not only in physical appearance, but in manners, how she conducted herself. So I suggest to you that the people she came in contact with would be drawn to her like metal would be to a magnet. We know the kind of person that is. We've all met people who are just so attractive within that you're just drawn to them. You know, you like being around them. And so she must have been that nice. Now, considering what we're told about Esther, I'm going to just draw a few contrasts to another woman in the Bible, to Ruth. Okay? So when we see, there's some contrast and some similarities. In the contrast, we see Ruth is a Gentile girl marrying a Jew. And in Esther, we see a Jew marrying a Gentile. In Ruth, we're shown the most humble of certain circumstances, poverty. And yet in Esther, we see riches, a great wealth with the king. In Ruth, we see the principle of individual salvation, and in Esther, we see national salvation. And in similarities between Ruth and Esther, we see in both a personal beauty which was, not literally, but crowned, Esther was crowned, okay, but Ruth wasn't, was crowned with a faithful, courageous, and a lovable character. Both of these books of the Old Testament reveal the hidden hand of God to the glory of His name and to the benefit of His people. As it was mentioned yesterday, God's name is not mentioned in the book of Esther, but it is loaded with providential inferences. Brother Johnny brought out yesterday in the comments, and as he talked about that a little bit, how the displacement of Vashti was setting up for that which was going to come to take place later on. And which years later on, too, by the way. Because remember, it was the third year in chapter 1. She's queen in the seventh year. So there's at least 4 years there. So in verse 8, we have the beginning of the search for the new queen. So verse 8 says, "So it came to pass when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace, to the custody of Hegai, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house, to the keeper of the woman." So she's taken along with many other beautiful women throughout the kingdom. Imagine your daughter being taken. And understanding this, that there was no coming back from this. Because if she was not selected queen, she was subjected to a life of a concubine. But we find that Esther finds favor in the eyes of Hegai. And here, she's got this probably wonderful way about her that she, you know, people just attracted to her, you know, physically as well as, you know, emotionally, if you would, you know. So we're told in verse 9 that she pleased Hegai. In this we can see that he was also taken by her natural beauty and pleasant way in the way she conducted herself. He enjoyed her company so much, and reading now from the New American Standard Bible, so he quickly provided her with cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice female attendants from the king's palace, and transferred her and her attendants to the best place in the harem. He liked her. He gave her preferential treatment. You can almost see how he wants her to be queen, right? So, and in this, we do see the hand of God. Okay, now it's continuing on, you know, the displacement of Vashti. Now we've got Hegai, you know, helping her. So, like I say, as all things with providence of God, it seems so natural. No one realizes that God's hand is at play. Now, I also suggest to you that there might be a little bit of a parallel to the life of Joseph. Well, Joseph was taken. Esther was taken. Joseph found favor with those who is in charge of him. Esther found favor with Hegai. He was placed in a position of power, as was Esther, ultimately. So it's a little, and it all seems so natural. So perhaps there's a little bit of a parallel there. Now, in verse 10, we're told that Esther does not reveal that she's a Jew. As it says, Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. Now, Mordecai, I suppose, when he realized what had happened, that she was taken, and he knew the outcome, either your queen or your concubine, right? Perhaps he, for whatever reason, he instructed her not to reveal her nationality, but we're not told why he did it. But knowing that Mordecai was a man of faith, and that it would have upset him so much that his cousin could be married to a Gentile, he may have thought upon this and about the possibility of her being queen. Maybe and placed in this position of honor, and that perhaps God was involved in this. Maybe he had some thoughts about that, though he could not have comprehended at all what the purpose behind it was, what was coming. He may have just allowed God to work the matter out according to his will. And isn't that something that we all have to do from time to time? We get to a point in our life, something comes, and we just say, well, it's in God's hands. And we have to do that with that faith. So Mordecai perhaps was feeling similarly. But he was anxious, wasn't he? Verse 11 says, and Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. Sort of like, the picture of the expectant father pacing up and down, back and forth, right? He certainly had to be very anxious. As any loving parent would have been, right? Now, we all experience situations where we are anxious about the outcome, even though we know in our minds we must leave it in the hands of God. But our faith is certainly tested. Now, verses 12 through 14, we're getting a little insight into the ritual of this here, the preparation for the encounter with the king. So apparently the queen was a pretty important position. It wasn't, that they went through, and that the king held this position so high in esteem, the people did as well, that a long course of preparation was required for each of the maidens who were selected as eligible for the honor of being bride. This is really incredible. They were subjected to a special course of instruction over 12 months. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with sweet odors and other things. That's incredible. But after the long preparation, each maiden was permitted to select whatever it was that she felt she needed for her presentation to the king. Now, apply modern-day women in the world to this, okay? You get the picture of what probably would happen, what they would want from jewels or whatever it is that they wanted to make themselves, to stand out, if you would. Now, because remember, if he does not select the woman as the queen, she is sent to the second house of the women, the residence of the concubine, to remain his property, not allowed to marry anyone else. Her life really would become a living death in that sense. And of course, we probably know that Mordecai knew this. So now, in verses 15 and 16, Esther's turn. Hegai, remember, he favored her. He probably really, in my opinion, wanted her to be queen. He gave her so much attention. But she doesn't require anything other than what he suggests. And there's some parallels there, too. Be content with food and raiment. Oh, that's what we're told. God knows what we need. She showed a faith in Hegai that he knew what she would need. He knew probably what the king would like. Okay? So she trusts him completely, as we're to trust completely in God's ability to care for us. So she put no confidence in artificial eggs. Again, applying this to modern day women's dress and attire and deportment, the simplicity wins the king over. Her natural beauty, and we hope that the bride of Christ, right? Remember, we hope to be part of the bride of Christ, because that's the way the bride of Christ, I believe, would appear before him. In simplicity, natural beauty, a loving deportment, if you would. So she goes into the king, and he's smitten with her, apparently. We're not told if there was any time after, but it almost makes it sound as if, okay, Esther, you're queen. I don't need to see anybody else. You know, he found his queen. And, you know, again, we hope to be part of that bride of Christ that we, you know, everyone's facing, that we hear those words, well done. Right? So, all those beautiful women, she gets selected. So, perhaps it went something like this. Okay? She enters the room where the king is. He was seated on his throne. The very personification of virtue and beauty walks into the room. Her modesty, simplicity, and graceful ways instantly appeals to him, right? She stands out far above everybody else. They had been sophisticated and artificial. She wasn't. She required no such aids. Perhaps she was like Eve to Adam, or perhaps Rebecca to Isaac. You know, we read the story of Isaac when he sees her from afar off, and he can almost sense the feeling of like joy or whatever he may experience when you read that, you know. So, simplicity of her dress, the loveliness of her countenance, reminds us a little bit more of a little bit like the virtual woman described by Solomon in Proverbs chapter 31, right? So, this humble Jewish maiden was suddenly elevated to a position of highest honor. Okay, now verse 18, it talks about Esther's feast. So now the king, he's all excited, he's happy. He wants to share this, and he wants her to be accepted. So he declares basically a holiday. You know, and the way it says this, the marriage of Esther to Ahasuerus was celebrated by a grand feast. The king invited all his realm to join with him in this happy time. As an assistance to that end, he issued a decree declaring a holiday, right? And he distributes gifts. Not only was he really, really happy, I mean, that's what sometimes people do. They're so happy, they give things away, right? He wants to share this happiness. So it brings joy to the people. She becomes beloved of the people as well. It says here, in Shushan itself, the marriage was celebrated in royal fashion. All rejoiced that the king had obtained a bride worthy to take the important place of Vashti. Thus this time of happiness, stemming from the king, extended to the palace and the capital, and reached out to the utmost limits of the whole empire. The marriage of Esther was a matter of rejoicing for everyone. And we can see the type, can't we? We can see the anti-type. The marriage of the marriage supper of the Lamb. Now, we're then told that Mordecai was sitting at the gate. So he has some kind of position. So it says, so I'm reading here, this is from Brother Mansfield, pretty much. He says, now Mordecai had a position of trust at the gate of the king, and as time went on, he was able to communicate with Esther, and she continued to obey Mordecai's instruction as she had when he was raising her. That's verse 20. Not to reveal her identity, Doubtless, he was awaiting God to reveal his purpose. Now, to think about this, Mordecai really was acting in a way very unselfishly. For there's no doubt that if the beautiful queen had revealed that he was her cousin, the king probably would have delighted to honor the man who had the position of trust at the gate and who was a cousin to the queen. But events were not to unfold that way, and Mordecai's action is sort of consistent with, you know, the way things, you know, God would want things, I think. Anyway. All right, verse 19. And this I'm going to throw out to you all, because it says the virgins were gathered a second time. So, you know, I've got Christadelphian Works, and I scanned all the Christadelphian magazines and all the books, you know, that are in Works, you know, from the Blessed Israel to Nazareth Revisited and so on. I could find no mention of this gathering of the virgins a second time. So I then decided to use the use the internet search. Say, what about other people think? So there's no consensus on this that I found. Okay? In fact, there's some, could be some pretty bizarre comments of people, what they think about it. But at any rate, there was a website called Bible Hub. And the one explanation that seemed to make some sense to me, I copied that one down. So it says in this commentary that I found, you know, from the, you know, those in the world, when the virgins were gathered together, and they said rather it's when virgins, leaving out the article the, so not when the virgins, but when virgins, the fact seems to be mentioned simply as furnishing a date. And we must suppose both that there was a second gathering and that the time when it happened was generally known to the Jews and Persians. Then Mordecai sat, etc. So the three verses, 19, 20, and 21, it is suggested by whoever wrote this commentary, they hang together and form a single sentence. When virgins were gathered together a second time and Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate, now Esther had not shown her kindred or people, as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther did the command of Mordecai like as when she was brought up with him. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, being of the number of them which kept the threshold, were wroth. So the point here, this one commentary was saying, you know, it's put all in there to get a reference of point in time, what was going on. I don't know if it is or isn't. I couldn't find anything on that. One other comment made a suggestion that perhaps the maidens were taken in two waves, but that didn't seem to fit, at least what I felt. But anyway, so that's just, I'll throw that out there. I'm no clue where it is exactly, you know, the full meaning of that. Now the chapter ends with the plot to kill the king. Now, but Johnny mentioned yesterday that, you know, we see the hand of God in this and so on. And, of course, the table is being set here now, isn't it? All right? Vashti is removed. Esther, okay, becomes the queen. Mordecai has a position of power, right? Well, not yet. He has an honorable position. His position of power is ultimately coming. So Esther sits upon the throne, okay? Mordecai in his humble position is at the gate. This apparently might have been a period of peace in the Persian Empire at that time. As we mentioned earlier, though it always wasn't always that way. The reign of Ahasuerus may have been a difficult one with a lot of battles. And he pretty much fended off all his enemies. But now two of his most trusted servants conspired to kill him. They were Bigthan and Teresh, two of the chamberlains, members of the king's bodyguard, who had charge of the threshold of the king's apartment. So they had easy access to him, especially at times of night. So they conspired to murder the king. And by some means, which we are not told, okay, this plot becomes known to Mordecai. Again, we see the hand of God here, okay, in providence and in helping, you know, this happen, that he learns about this. So quickly and secretly, he gets word to Esther. Esther then notifies the king. They have an inquiry, whatever. It is determined that it was true, and these guys are executed. But nothing gets recorded about it. I mean, I'm sorry, gets recorded, but nothing is done about it for Mordecai. And that becomes a significant thing, what's going to happen later on. Okay? When we get into Haman and all the plot to kill the Jews. So the incident is closed to all those concerned. Yet this small incident, as we mentioned, is going to play a most vital part, okay, in the preservation of the Jewish people. God was behind it. And later on, we'll see how that plays out. So, concluding sentence. Thus we see this chapter, a lot of small matters, a lot of little things happening, okay, and all appearing in natural ways. So we see how the hand of God, through his providence, are continuing for the benefit of God's people. So this second chapter, like I say, introduces us to that. There might be some who may scoff that, it's really an inspired book. God's name's not even mentioned to it. Read between the lines. It's all there. We can easily see how, this is going to play out. And it's a type. We've seen it in Hitler. We're going to see it again, right? We're seeing it now. There's going to be someone out there that wants to destroy the Jews, as it seems always. Whether they were being thrown out of Spain or Germany or wherever it might be, until he who comes, whose right it is, to sit on the throne and establish that kingdom.
Thank you, Brother Len. Great opening comments. Now we've got some time for discussion, comments, questions. On the floor for anyone? Brother Johnny?
Good morning, brothers and sisters. It's interesting these examples that were given in Esther, but we got to remember they're just simple types. We can't get too dogmatic of all the technical meaning behind it in relation to prophecy and such, but they do have a purpose. Now, Brother Lennon questioned that second gathering of the virgins in verse 19, when they were gathered the second time, and Mordecai sat in the king's gate. Well, prior to this, we see, if we look at the fact that Christ came the first time to his people and they rejected him, and they didn't accept him, but in that case, and then when he comes again, he has the marriage supper of the Lamb. He meets with his bride, and she becomes his bride, just like Mordecai and Esther here. But then Christ goes into Jerusalem the second time, and they don't know who he is. Who is this that comes from Edom, the dyed garments from Bozrah, who just took on and destroyed the Russian host? They don't have any idea. And so they don't know Yahweh, and they don't know Christ. And Paul, I believe it is, in Acts, speaks of Joseph with his brethren in 13, chapter 7. At the second time, Joseph was made unto his brethren, and Joseph's kindred was made unto Pharaoh. And so we kind of see the same thing that, yes, they're married, but Christ has to be revealed to the Jews yet. And Esther and her people have to be revealed, not just to the king, but to the whole Shushan the palace, the whole nation. And so it's after that marriage supper, when Christ returns into Jerusalem, they acknowledge him as their Messiah and realize they murdered their Messiah, that they mourn, and then the rest of the world finds out who God's people are, who Esther's people are. So it all fits the type, perhaps. Maybe there's another explanation, but it seems to me that, yeah, as we say, it can't get too dogmatic, but these things certainly point forward to the future.
Brother Seth?
Yeah, I think I know of what Brother Lynn was talking about when he was discussing why virgins were gathered together a second time. And I recall one of the Bibles I had was just talking about how inhumane, essentially, this queen selection process was. And it's difficult to talk about it without being indiscreet. I'm going to certainly try my hardest. The thing about the selection process that has been suggested is, yes, these virgins are gathered together so the next queen will be selected. But when the virgin goes before the king for that one night, it's not merely a supper, it's not merely a conversation, it's highly suggested a relationship is consummated and she is no longer a virgin, and that's how she ended up as a concubine in his harem. He wasn't just looking for a queen, his harem was being expanded. And I think the second time the virgin's together, he's still expanding it. Why would he do this when a queen was selected, a queen that was the ultimate perfection? It's just the human way to want more and more. So it's unfortunate Esther had to go through this unpleasant experience, but did put her in a position that would save her people. And that's just some thoughts on it.
Brother Ben?
Yeah, some good thoughts thus far, and thanks, Brother Lynn. I think if we look at the origins of Esther, we can definitely see the parallels with the Gentiles who are called unto the truth. We're told that Esther was adopted by Mordecai. He took her on as his own daughter, because her parents had deceased, and so she was adopted. Well, Gentiles are adopted into the Jewish hope. She was grafted in. The original queen was displaced, and she entered in as the replacement. Well, same with the Gentiles. They're grafted into the Jewish hope. So it's, as Brother Lenny said, there may be no mention of the word Lord or God in this book, but the inferences are undeniable. It is totally encompasses the whole plan of salvation that God has laid in place. And as far as Mordecai instructing Esther not to reveal her people or her kindred, we might at first think that, you know, we're trying to keep it quiet, don't want anybody to know, but that's far from the case. There were bigger events that were to come to pass that would come into play. Like Brother Lenny said, it's a bunch of little things that seem, you know, just natural and just whatever happens. But, you know, we know the hand of God is working all along. And we know at Christ's first advent, he came in like a lamb. It wasn't his time to bring out the vengeance and the judgments that God would have on the people and the nations and the land, but he was preaching the gospel. Now, Esther is coming in subtly. He is kind of just in the shadows, as it were. And because when Haman is elevated, when sin and the kingdom of men is in its height, it is then that Christ will come back on the scene, and he will call those faithful ones to Mount Sinai for judgment and for preparation to assist him in his conquests of the nations. And that is when the saints will be revealed to the world. Because now they're basically unknown. We know them as God's people. The Bible reveals them as God's people. But to anyone else, it's just the Jews, just another race of people, and they're despised and shunned. But when the time comes, they'll be revealed. And it'll be undeniable to the world this second time when the nationality, God's people, it's obvious to everyone. And that's when, you know, Christ will, as Mordecai later on, will be elevated. When sin is put down, Haman is hung on the gallows, which he had made for Christ, for Mordecai here. And Haman is hung on his own gallows. And it's interesting that the two chamberlains, there were two next to Mordecai, who we know is a type of Christ. It parallels the two that were crucified on crosses on either side of Christ. the two thieves. So again, another connection to Christ. I think over 10 times in this book it says that Mordecai sat in the king's gate. So it's obvious that he was a very influential figure in this whole account. And we know that Christ is the gate. He's the door. He's the way, the truth, and the life, and the only way to get into God's kingdom. And I think what Brother Seth was saying about the process of appearing before the king and to go in unto the king and sleep with the king, and they would be added to his harem. Well, in a spiritual sense, when we go through this period of preparation and appear before the king, whether we're selected or not, we are still in covenant relations with him. We can't get out of those. There's no backing out. There's no going back. We're in his house, whether we choose to live as he wishes or not, we're still under that oath. So we're his property. We're his sons and daughters, whether we act like them or not. So I think the connections here to the plan of salvation is undeniable. You can go on and on.
For the girl.
It's been mentioned a couple of times that God is not mentioned in this book. Now that statement is correct as far as it's intended, because God is not literally named in the book. But his name is in the book if you look for it, and you can find it. In the sixth verse, it says that it's talking about Mordecai came came from Judah when Adonijah, there's Yah in this, and then when they came from Judah, and then in the lineage, in I think it's the 15th verse, but the lineage of Mordecai and Esther. It's Abihail, which is Ael, another name for God. So it's there. Like I said, what was said, it's not literally used in the book, and that's a correct statement. But God's name is in the book in the sense of it's used in the names of a lot of the people in the book. And those two names just came from this reading.
Just a note on this 19th verse here. The person looks at the New Living Translation version. It says this: even after all the young women had been transferred to the second harem. So take that for what it says. It's another version on that verse 19. Any other questions, comments? Brother Jeremy?
I think one of the reasons why Mordecai didn't want his cousin Esther to tell anyone was the fact that they were in bondage. They weren't in slavery, but they were in a foreign land, and their hope, along with Mordecai, Esther, Ezra, and many other faithfuls, was to get back to Israel. And I think they were trying to work a plan, and that was God's plan, is to get them back. And it was God's plan to put them there in the first place. But I think it was the plan of Mordecai. It wasn't said here, but I think maybe that is one of the reasons why he said not to say anything, so Esther could come to some point of power and Mordecai, working at the gate, would work with Esther. And we see in the future that Ezra also was there working, and then finally had that petition signed that they could return back to Israel.
I think we'll call Brother Glenn. One last comment from Brother Glenn.
Now, as we're going through this, I can't help but think about Queen Vashti, you know, ex-Queen Vashti, you know, and she's still around as far as we can tell. She's still there, but she's not in the picture. But she would have to know what's going on. She would have to be aware of the selection of a new queen and how that's all going. And she's not a part of it. Now, she's been cast out, you know, from that highest position that a woman could have in the kingdom. And it's been given to another. And I can't help but think of whenever we're at the judgment seat of Christ and the judgment's going on, and some are accepted and some are rejected. And, you know, I've always thought, well, you know, part of the punishment of the rejected is to see the salvation of those who are accepted. And I was thinking about how Vashti would be subject to those, to that loss. You know, she lost it all. Now she's just a regular woman in a life that she can't get out of. And so anyway, it's just something to think about. You know, when we're at the judgment seat, we don't want to be the one that's rejected and see everybody else being, you know, all those accepted going into God's favor and receiving divine spiritual nature and all those wonderful things that we can't imagine.